Tonight, we are once again returning to this exploration, this deepening of our understanding of equanimity as it's understood in the Buddhist teachings and reflected in Buddhist psychology. And we do so, we return to this over and over again because we basically return to all the teachings over and over again. That's the way it works, is this revisiting. We gradually go deeper, you can imagine circling it over and over again. And as we keep circling a key understanding in the tradition, it deepens. It's like we wear a path into, and we discover something new this time that we had not before. Or we simply remember something that we had heard before, but we had forgotten. And so it is with equanimity. Equanimity is one of the four Brahma Viharas. Brahma Viharas are the heavenly abode, the qualities of mind, heart, that it is said the only experiences of mind that an arahant, one totally liberated, experiences, that of loving kindness, that of compassion, that of sympathetic joy, and that of equanimity, that a fully liberated mind does not have other kinds of emotions run through it. And over the years, I've gradually come to imagine how that might be true, that I can really like feel how that would conceivably be possible for someone to do in a particular lifetime. And the equanimity in relation to the Brahma Viharas, the four heavenly abodes, that it plays a balancing factor for each of the three, for the metta, for the loving kindness. It is without the equanimity, we can get carried away in our loving kindness in various kinds of ways that where we actually lose. We lose that a proper level of it, and we it gets diluted by our personality without the equanimity. And compassion without the equanimity, we get lost in compassion fatigue, or simply the fatigue of paying attention for it. I'm not sure compassion fatigue is quite the right word, but whatever that is. And then the same with sympathetic joy. Without equanimity, someone's happiness, sympathetic joy is happiness for the happiness of another. Without equanimity, we can fall into envy on the one hand, and on the other hand, to over-identification where we know what will make them happy. And it's too important that we want them to be happy, and we lose the proper boundaries and actually take away a person's autonomy with at the same time thinking, oh, we're being so loving to this person and so want their happiness. So that's the way it plays out in the traditional teachings in terms of the Brahma Viharas. In terms of the other place that comes up so frequently is in what are called the awakening factors, which starts with mindfulness as an awakening factor. And that is awakens the mind, it brings the mind into the present, to the here and now with wisdom. These awakening factors function in that way. And it starts with mindfulness, because mindfulness is present in all of the other awakening factors, including equanimity. But likewise, it ends in equanimity, and equanimity is a balancing factor once again for mindfulness, and keeps it from falling into identification with what's one's being mindful of. And so, again, we're not talking about the Brahma Viharas or the awakening factors in general tonight, but just to repeat them for you, starting with mindfulness, which is this ability to be present in the moment, the here and the now, with whatever is arising, and in a way that is not a distant observer, but is a participant observer. So one has a felt sense of the experience, not this distant conceptual recognition of the present, but what this moment's experience feels like to the mind heart, what it feels like, not a distant, uninvolved conceptualization. And again, you must have equanimity for that. And then there's these so-called energizing factors of investigation, of energy, and of joy that helps us really stay present even when it's difficult, because we're interested. These factors make us more interested, and if the mind is resistant because it's difficult what we're experiencing and we don't want to do it, or the mind's filled with sloth and torpor, or discouragement, and so forth, these awakening factors help us get through that discouragement, that sloth, that torpor. And then there's the remaining three are calming factors or balancing factors to the awakening factor, to the energetic factors, and they are starting with calm, and then concentration, and then equanimity. So the mind is balanced. And this is how wisdom arises, is we've got a mind that's got this kind of balance. It's available to investigate, but it's not caught in what it's investigating. And it's not caught in an outcome from what it's investigating. And thus, again, the equanimity being so important in this. The traditional word for equanimity that is most often used is upeka. And like at Spirit Rock, one of the dorms is called upeka. And often said, not always, but it's often said that upeka, this equanimity, comes out of concentration, because in that sequence of the seven awakening factors. In my own experience, I don't find it limited to that. So first of all, there's a difference between calm and equanimity. Sometimes people will say that you can't have equanimity without calm. But I have not found that to be true at all. So in terms of a deep concentration, there will come a calm before equanimity. But that's in deep concentration practice. In regular practice, when the mind is not all that deeply concentrated, the mind can have more equanimity, in my experience, than it does have calm. So the mind's not very calm, but it's equanimous around not being calm. It's like running around and worrying about this, worrying about that, and you're there just watching it run around, not being calm at all. This to me is very important distinction, and I take every opportunity to present my view of this, because I find people thinking that they have to have a calm mind and be able to stay on the anchor object like we use the breath for, or the body in our guided meditation this evening. But that is not true in my experience. Your mind can be upset about something, but you still have a kind of balance to it. Equanimity is balance. Calm is calm. It's prasada in Pali. So they're different factors. They're just very different factors. And at a particular stage of our development, we may have lots of times when our mind's not calm. Our mind's filled with our passions for or against something. We're all involved in the soap opera of life. But if we develop more equanimity while that's going on, we gradually become less and less defined by what's going on and more characterized by it only. And that's part of this, a combination of equanimity and mindfulness, sati. In this way, so that is that. The equanimity as a balanced state of mind is a reference to a kind of inner balance. It has I'll just stop with that for now. This equanimity and this sense of the word upeka relates to what's called clear understanding in the teaching of mindfulness. This clear understanding that you have, if with a certain degree of equanimity, even if you're having a difficult time, or the world is very difficult right now, as it is for us, so both on a national level and international level, there's so much suffering that we're so aware of, and there's so much reason for people in our community to be frightened, and around the country, and then around the world. So the equanimity in this sense allows for us to stay present and to see it, to see what the mind is doing. So looking at the mind getting too caught in a way that is not helpful to anybody, not to ourselves or anyone else. There's a second word, in addition to upeka, that gets translated as balance. And I first heard this from Gil Franzlo, one of my colleagues at Spirit Rock, and his own Dharma Center, as well. And this word is, I'm not sure I'm going to pronounce it right, Tatra Majjata, which is made up of three words. Like in the Majjhima Nikaya, those discourses, the middle length discourses. So Majja is middle, and Tatra is there. Tatra is like here right now, just right now, and then for some reason I'm blanking on the third word here, the third part of this, but it's the ability to stand in the middle of it all, to do what I call stand under, that I learned from Samedo, the idea of to bear, as I understood it from Helen Luke's teachings, who's not a Buddhist but was quite a wise woman. And so this kind of word for equanimity is more, it's not this because your mind is concentrated, but your mind has stability. So it can ride the waves of up and down. It's like you're in the boat, you're going across the currents, and the boat's hitting that current going this way over and over again. And you know, you're moved around with it. But you are still standing present. You may be being blown around by the wind, but you're still staying present. And in daily life, this is a very useful kind of equanimity, this understanding of equanimity in this way. It refers to a kind of inner strength to be able to stay present, and this would be called equanimity. Without it, the mindfulness can get overwhelmed. You're being very mindful, but you still get swept away. You get swept away into fear or anger or such sadness over something in your own life or in the world or both. And it allows us to be actively participating in the face of the eight worldly winds, as the Buddha described it, of gain and loss, pain and pleasure, fame and ill repute, and praise and blame. That in these worldly winds, we're able to stay present. We're not, okay, right now I'm being blamed, right now I'm being praised. Another way to understand that is, like in my own life right now, I have a number of factors that are challenging factors in my life. Challenging in terms of time, that I have more things that I have feel a responsibility for than I have the time and energy, big emphasis on that energy, to do well. And one of my values that I'm very clear about is to do things as well as I'm able. but I am under a certain constraint that is just because of time and energy, that I can't do all these things well, and some things aren't getting done at all, and some things are not being done to a level that that I would be comfortable with. But that's the way it is right now. So whatever I contributed to that and life circumstances contributed to it, it's the way it is. That's the equanimity. Going into self-blame getting lost in self-blame would not make me more effective. It would make me less effective. Blaming others, because I could certainly do that, would make me less effective. That would not do anything. You know, maybe for some of us, that sometimes blaming others brings some short-term degree of comfort, but the cost is way too high. Recognizing the unskillfulness of others allows you to understand how to interact skillfully with them in those areas where that's true. But the actual blame is something extra. It's not helpful in this way. So there we are. We have this two ways of understanding equanimity. One is shelter. The mind is so sheltered because the mind is so equanimous that nothing disturbs it. In our meditation practice, there is what's called neighborhood concentration, or another word for it, access concentration. And at that point, the mind starts to be sheltered, that even though the hindrance of mind, restlessness and wanting and aversion are rising, the mind recognizes them but does not get thrown off balance, doesn't lose its thread of concentration, because there's enough concentration that it's sheltered from feeling it directly. I had an experience in my meditation last week, one evening, where I was sitting with some pain, and so I was seeing the pain as physical pain, and from there I was going, you know, it's really true about dukkha. You know, I was just having that as a recognition. It's really true, because I was that my physical pain was bringing up the association of the pain in the world as I experience it going on right now. And I was feeling pain as I was saying, oh, that's just dukkha. And stream dukkha, for those of you who don't know, dukkha is like the unsatisfactoriness of life, the physical and emotional pain of life, the fact that it's always changing, that there's not any kind of a there to life. All of this is dukkha, and the liberation comes not by getting rid of dukkha, but by changing our relationship to it. So there I was having this experience, and my mind had gotten concentrated around it. I think the pain had first concentrated my mind, because it will do that, you know, if you can tolerate it. But I wasn't really trying to have any kind of a deep practice. I was just doing my practice. I was not highly motivated. But then this arose as kind of a wonderment, like, because I could really feel, I could feel the truth of dukkha. At that point, my mind was sheltered. And I was interested in all of this, but again, not in control. I was not inclining the mind in any way. This all just was spontaneous. I want to stress that, because we sometimes think that we've got to incline the mind a lot. We've got to control it, but don't just stay in present. Just staying present can bring us lots of things. So there I was having that experience. And then, I don't know if you know the drawings of William Blake. He's kind of... So in the middle of nowhere, this drawing of William Blake's that I had not seen in at least 40 years just popped up. And it was so vivid. And I had contemplated this when I was a young man. What are these mean? And it never occurred to me to see this particular drawing as dukkha. And I was going, oh, this is his expression of the dukkha and how to be with the dukkha. I have no idea if that's true, by the way. But that was my experience in that moment. And it stayed for a period of time as an image, imago, an image that added to the concentration. That image arising could have popped me out of the equanimity, out of the conditions where this image was arising, just the very arising of it, which was really interesting. And then this new insight about this that could have popped me into thinking mind. It was being equanimous with something interesting arising. That was what kept me in my practice state. So it's not just when things that are difficult that arise. It's equally when things that really can capture us, that pull us into our wanting mind, that where we cease to be what we're about. This can be true when you're loving someone. You can get so excited about what you want from them that you cease to remember, oh, I want to be a loving person to them. We can cease to be generous to someone we care for because they mean so much to us because of what they're giving us. There's not an equanimity that keeps us connected to our values. You following me on this? Mm-hmm. This is really important. So equanimity, this equanimous mind, allows us to stay present in our intentional, to have an intentional life be manifest. An intentional life, part of the Eightfold Path, Samasamkhapa. I talk about intention all the time, so you can go back and listen to many talks on that. But the intention, and intention and mindfulness are joined at the hip. This intentional mindfulness or mindful intention is what allows us to live the life we wish to live in a way that has a sense of authenticity, continuity, coherence. Again, I've said this so many times from many of you have sat through. But the equanimity allows us to keep our balance when things arise. Yesterday, I had the great privilege of visiting with my teacher, which I don't get to do that often because he lives in Thailand, the Venerable Ajahn Sumedho, and he's up at the Abhayagiri Monastery, and today was at least the celebration of his birthday. It's a little unclear because he and Ajahn Pasna were both celebrating birthdays, and it was a little unclear to me exactly if this was the exact date of his birthday or not. But today, I wasn't there for it, but they had a big celebration of his birthday. But I was up there yesterday visiting with him. And he's undergoing some real health challenges. He's 83. He's turning 83 right now. And he's undergoing some real health challenges. And we spent about an hour just in one-on-one private time, personal time. And not a wrinkle in the equanimity around these really difficult personal health challenges. Not a wrinkle, not a blip, just this. And that kind of equanimity is a form of being concentrated, but it's in the concentrated in I am collected and unified that allows me to stand under, to stand there in the middle of it. To stand there in the middle of it. Do you see? So in our own lives, this seems to me to be wise to cultivate, but also it's a very challenging time in our country, and the differences are growing larger, and those differences have a degree of difference at some point, then it can escalate to further acting out in ways that cause a lot of people suffering all the way around. We do not have commonality, not to a common purpose right now. And so this equanimity, otherwise the heart will shut down. And if we close our heart to the larger community, it bounces back to ourselves. Likewise, if we lack equanimity in terms of our own ethical base, our own precepts that we take in terms of right action and right speech, without equanimity, we can be acting unskillfully in our speech or in our actions and not be able to own it, because we don't have enough equanimity to, we have to be in a kind of denial. We split off. So we say things that are not skillful, and we can't own it, so we can't make amends. And also we can't stop saying it, so we say something else. Or we act in some way that's harmful to another, or we take what's not been freely given, or we take too much, or whatever that's not appropriate. But we lack the equanimity to be able to go, oh, I wish I hadn't have done that. And therefore, we can't make amends. And we're much more likely to repeat it. So the mindfulness without the equanimity alone, say that more clearly. Mindfulness alone can't, everything's connected to everything else in Buddhist psychology. So the mindfulness rest counts on equanimity. So as we bring up our equanimity, we empower our mindfulness, just as our mindfulness empowers the equanimity. This may be more relevant to you than you think, or it may be less relevant than you think. I haven't a clue. This is where investigation comes in. You reflect, you inquire. You just, as you go through this next few days, you go, does this shoe fit or not? Is this something I need to wear for a few days mindfully, that I need to consciously work on equanimity in relation to my life, either in my immediate life, my practice life, or my life in community in this way? So the idea that, again, to say the equanimity is the mind is sheltered, and then also as the mind is able to stay present in the midst of the turmoil, and it's not sheltered in the same way. It is being bounced by the things, but it is able to come back to center. So both those understandings. And again, not everybody would have that second one, but I do. And then there are these various things we can do to help with develop equanimity if we're interested. You know, sometimes when you're really under the gun, that motivates you to develop equanimity, and that's terrific. But it's my experience that it's very useful to develop equanimity when we're not under the gun, because lots of times we're under the gun and we're feeling so much pressure, we can't just get grounded enough. We can't find the ground. And the more we have worked on equanimity in advance, no matter our age — this is not an age-based talk at all — no matter our age, no matter our circumstances of health, wealth, capacities, that this is a truism, that it is greatly advantageous to us to have worked on this equanimity. That's for you to decide for yourself. So insofar as you are interested, I'm going to give you a series of things that I have, that I've utilized myself, and that I've also heard others say. And it starts with knowing what you mean by equanimity. Because, again, a lot of people confuse this calm with equanimity. And I've heard people teach that way, and yet they're clearly different words. And I mean, they're listed, they're not even next to each other in the awakening factors. So knowing the difference between calm as a mental state, a mental factor, and equanimity as a mental factor. Calm is calm. You're calm or you're not calm. You know what calm is. We'll be taking questions, but you do know what calm is, because everybody can use it. Just as the water is calm or not calm, just so our mind is calm or not calm, or the body can be calm or not calm. And then equanimity is this balance factor. So knowing that difference, so knowing what you mean when you use the word, or you consider the aspiration to develop more equanimity. And then second is to utilize this very, very important Buddhist teaching around what creates insight, is that you recognize in yourself, under various circumstances and conditions, what equanimity feels like, so that you know that you have a felt sense of when the mind has, when the mind is equanimous. You have a felt sense of it. You know the felt sense of an equanimous mind. In practice, I love that moment when the mind has become so concentrated that it is sheltered. Because I have done such so many retreats over so many years, I recognize it instantly. And a wave of gratitude flows through my body because the hindrances are sheltered. You know, for how long, one doesn't know. But there's no question they're sheltered. Again, I'm saying they are not absent. The mind is sheltered from them being swept away by the hindrances of mind. It's only in a deeper absorption that you don't feel them at all. But for Vipassana practice, for insight practice, the hindrances are very useful to have around when you're not caught in them, because then you get to study them, you get to investigate them, and see your relationship to them and all, and with equanimity. So that felt sense of equanimity. And then in the Satipatthana Sutta, the Sutta of the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, it's often not stressed maybe sufficiently, but the teachings about recognizing whether equanimity and all the other awakening factors, the teaching is twofold: to recognize the presence of them and how to cultivate the presence of them, but equally to recognize the absence of equanimity and how to bring the mind towards equanimity when it's not present. So presence and absence. That's the same with the hindrances. It's the same with pleasant and unpleasant. This is the presence and absence is an important part of the teaching. That would be, I should make that a whole Dharma talk about presence and absence, so I'll stop there. Another way that can help with noticing the equanimity is to, when it's nearby, it's you, like your mind's only a little disturbed, just notice, oh, could I come back to being this too? So let's suppose you're in the grocery store and somebody does something that mildly disturbs you, or all the avocados are too ripe, and there's this sense of that triggers something about not having enough control in your life, and it triggers something. So your mind loses that that equanimity in some way. If that happens, then be interested. Can I just bring it back? Just gently, just like, oh, look at this. Use your mindfulness to say, oh, look at this. The mind is exploding over the fact that what's really true is there's not any avocados available right now. And and then likewise, when we've got a certain degree of equanimity, but it's unstable. Like we feel like we could lose it. Like, okay, I'm going through this. Be very interested in that, and just be mindful of the fact that it is there, and the staying with it. Just staying with it in that way. When it's not present, be interested in its absence and how that feels without going into judging mind. Oh, I should have equanimity. Without going into comparing mind, you know, I used to be better at this, or on retreat I'm better, or, you know, my friend who is also sort of my rival in the Dharma, with her practice, you don't compare to her or to perfection, but you're just interested, and then when there's not equanimity. One hint of that is when you can feel the reactivity of mind, and you feel possessed by that reactive mind. So if you notice reactivity, you can see, and how, do I have equanimity even amidst this reactivity, or not? And then this remembering that you wish to have a responsive mind. Remember that a reactive mind has few choices because it's identifying with what's happening. Whereas a responsive mind, when something difficult is happening or something overly positive is happening and we're getting caught in that, a responsive mind only is characterized by what's happening. But a reactive mind is defined by it. When the mind is being defined, there's not equanimity. Maybe there's an exception to that, but it's a general thing. So those are kind of regular guidelines. There's virtue and integrity support. When the mind has virtue and integrity, there tends to be more equanimity. When we don't have virtue, we really get split. We really do. As part of that, I would say being able to own to ourselves and to another when we've been unskillful. Faith in this, not belief, but faith, knowing that the practice has worked for you in other ways, that this faith, this trusting the practice, trusting the mindfulness, trusting the intention, all the things you're learning, having faith in them, say, I'm going to rely on them. I can't perfectly execute them, but hey, these make sense to me, and they've worked some, so I'm going to rely on them because I don't have anything better to rely on. I can't take a drug that will suddenly give me equanimity and also be present. I can take a drug that will knock me out or alter my mind in some way that I can't access my lack of equanimity, but there's no development in that. And then any sense of well-being helps with the equanimity. When we start to have a sense of well-being that is less and less dependent on conditions, the more equanimity can arise. And then, of course, using insight around this to bring our insight. Oh, this is skillful or unskillful. This is causing problems. And to say, and to use the insight around Nietzsche, the insight about letting go, everything we know about letting go, about that demanding that things be other than they are is not usually a very successful strategy. One of the challenges I'm facing right now, it's a worldly challenge, and for about 36 hours, I was really like, what am I going to do about this? What am I going to do about this? And I was really feeling, the potential loss and all. And then after, and maybe it wasn't quite 36, but it was more than 24, I realized, oh, well, then I'll just start over with that condition. And all of that angst just, still would rather, not have the loss, but just start over. Just like we do when we come back to the breath. Just start over. You just let go. You wanted it to be one way. Was that way. It's fair that it's that way, maybe, but no longer that way. So now it's not that way. You just let go. That's an insight level. That letting go, that ability to know that things are always changing, that the truth that we see from our insight practice, that really gives a ground for equanimity in this way. And with that, my remarks I bring to a close around this topic, and briefly open if there's any question or comment around equanimity. Yes, please.
So, first of all, thank you for all of it, and thank you for the distinction between calm and equanimity.
Hold like you on ice cream, that's sort of going the recording.
Thank you for all of it, and thank you for the distinction between calm and equanimity. So I'm curious, if I don't appear calm or I'm not sounding calm, but I'm grounded in my values, I'm grounded in my experiences, I'm grounded in self-belief, I'm not even sure what my question is, but I know that I'm in a situation where I feel very grounded in my experience and in my values and my trainings and my education, mm-hmm. but I know I'm not always expressing myself as a calm professional.
Right.
And
So the distinction there is, are you aware of it as it's happening? Are you okay with the fact you wish that you could express yourself clearly, but you can't? But you know that that's true, and you're okay with that. The equanimity allows you to not get swept away by the fact that in your excitement that you can't express yourself. That's the difference. If you get swept away in your story of, oh, I can't express myself because I'm so emotional, then you're lacking of equanimity. But if you can just go, oh, I wish I were, and I can feel this, oh, man, here, then you have equanimity, but you don't have calm. You're agitated, you're excited, or whatever it is.
And it's not that I feel I can't express myself. Sometimes I'm feeling like I'm not, that the person I might be speaking with doesn't want to hear what I have to say.
Yeah, same thing would apply. Yeah. There's a whole other thing about that is that be very interested in, for myself at least, I'm always interested in my need to express myself in those situations. What is that? And am I really out of balance? And that's why there's this compulsive need. That compulsive need to express ourselves is when we are defined by that situation. So there's a natural response of wanting to, a responsive mind might want to express itself, but if it's reactive in this huge need to, then we don't have equanimity around it usually. Then back on the floor right behind you.
Thank you. In a situation where one is not feeling okay, as a speaker or any other, with how I am being, and equanimity is being okay with not being okay.
Yes.
Then could you say a little bit about how it's not exactly intention or motivation to change the circumstances that are underlying that are not okay arise when I'm finding myself okay with it not being okay? How do I
This is actually a very subtle question, because at least in my own development of practice, I have struggled at various points with, it is really okay for things not to be okay, so what is my motivation for making them okay? Particularly as applied to myself. Other people, it's more applied to the world. I don't get very confused about the world. It's not okay that certain horrible things are happening in the world, and I can, even in those times when I know it's perfect, there's a whole perspective where everything's perfect. That does, even in that state, my sense of what I would believe is right doesn't get swerved. But about myself, it can be very confusing. And I've heard other people talk about working with monastics around their bodies and the not having enough interest in their body to take care of it more, even though why wouldn't they, out of compassion? And that being a challenge because of this development of that. So there you are. You have you're okay with things not being okay, and then the next question is, what would compassionate wisdom call for in this situation? So for me, because with my body, that is what I rely on to have me take care of my body, is compassionate wisdom. Because I don't have that, I have a lot of equanimity around the body being however it is. So, because I'm not pain averse. It's not organized that way. So I use this compassionate wisdom. Why wouldn't I take responsibility for this body? Why wouldn't I? If I don't, who will? And the equanimity is not indifference, you see, but the equanimity means that it allows me to not have to have the body get better. Do you see? So, but we need the compassion. We need the compassion along with the wisdom. That's what makes the Dhamma fly, is compassion wing and the wisdom wing, for that reason. And so we have to watch out about that in relation to anything. There's a degree to which I'm willing to be taken advantage of, which in my other life, before my Dharma life, that was not something that happened very often. That was not someone you would want to easily choose to take advantage of. There was a high cost to pay for that. But that's not true now. So I sometimes have to arouse myself to go out of compassion. If this person takes advantage of me, am I encouraging them to take advantage of the next person? You see? So you see the ethics that I am holding for their own karma and for the benefit of others. Everybody with this, right?
Yeah.
So it's subtle, all of this. And it goes into understandings of what makes a community safe, and I could go on and on with that, but I think that points you in a direction.
Thank you.
So I think we need to stop with that. We're going to, again, for the people who are new, we're going to sit for a few minutes, and then the metta cards will be read, and then we will close with saying love and kindness. We'll close with saying love and kindness out loud, the metta phrases out loud, and encourage you to participate in that. One thing that that's really wonderful about this Sangha, and I'm saying this for those of you who are new or relatively new to it, it is a Sangha where everybody truly is welcome. And sometimes we can be here and that, you know, it seems like people are different than us for one reason or another, of every kind of difference in the world. and because we're mostly in silence, that can build. And so the regular community members well know that part of their job is to have everyone feel welcome. But sometimes it can feel funny to walk up and say, "Oh, who are you?" And I'm so and so. I will often have time that we introduce at the first for this, although doing that every week is too much. So just to really know that you are really welcome here, and all of us really appreciate as much difference of every kind as possible. It so makes a community richer. Every kind of difference makes a community richer, and there's real aspiration for that. And but sometimes it's not so easy to help cultivate and convey that value, and I wanted to say that before we sat. So, closing our eyes if you're comfortable. Come back into the body. Feel the body here, now. Shift attention to the mind with the body in the background. You're still including the body, but you're more interested in the mind state. Would you say there is equanimity in the mind or not? Not how much, you're not doing great, but any amount of equanimity. The mind that comes. And what is the felt sense?